From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Historically, black colleges and universities have always served black students, but the faculty used to be mostly white.
Black colleges were an interesting place. Most of them, during that period, had white presidents. And they were run in a very draconian kind of way, with moral codes and with lots of rules. The white presidents were completely ill-equipped.
Today, filmmaker Stanley Nelson joins us to talk about his new documentary on the history of HBCUs. It premieres tonight on PBS. But first, many of you continue to weigh in on a show we did a few weeks ago about the debate over Confederate monuments. Here are your first thoughts. Ned Dominick called us to say these monuments tell a deep story.
I've lived in the South for 50 years now. The monuments to the Confederacy are basically an anachronism. They're pretty cool, to tell you the truth. They tell a story that really happened. The Southerners lost hundreds of thousands of soldiers, as did the Union. But the Union won. So all these are statues. And if you want to put labels on them that explain that slavery was an issue of the Confederacy, well, then feel free to explain the obvious. But don't move them.
We'd love getting your thoughts. So, where do you think Confederate monuments belong? You can call and tell us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter, at OSD Talk, or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Last week, more heartache for Americans, the tragedy in Parkland, Florida, since Sandy Hook in 2012. In 2013, a similar scene played out at Decatur's Ronald E. McNair Discovery Learning Academy. Thankfully, no one was killed, but a young man did begin firing a gun. A school employee, Antoinette Tuff, talked the gunman down.
Hey, can police was addressing your emergency?
Yes, ma'am. I'm on 2nd Avenue in the school, and the gentleman said, tell them to hold down. The police officer are coming, and he said he's going to start shooting, so tell them to back off.
Okay, one moment.
Do not let anybody in the building. Including the police. Do not let anybody in the building, including the police.
There's a new short film based on what happened. It's called DeKalb Elementary.
Call 911. Tell them to hold the police back. They come in, I'm going to start shooting.
I'm on 2nd Avenue in the elementary school. There's a gentleman here with a gun, and he said, tell the police to back off or he's going to start shooting.
I'm in the front office. Ooh, he just went outside and started shooting.
That's a scene from DeKalb Elementary. It's nominated for an Oscar in the live-action short film category. I talked a couple weeks ago with Reed Van Dyke, its writer and director. He explained why he chose to tell this story as a short film.
What actually transpired between Antoinette and Michael actually took about 20 to 30 minutes. And so when I first heard the phone call, the 911 recording, I couldn't stop thinking about the two of them and that sort of amazing encounter that they'd had. And as I thought about, as I thought more about the two of them, I thought perhaps it would lend itself well to a short film.
Let's actually hear a moment. The gunman, as you say, was in control for a very short period of time, 15 minutes or so, and he does develop a connection with the school employee. So in this clip from your film, the employee is talking with the shooter as he prepares to give himself up, and she first speaks to the police.
He said he's ready now. He needs to go to the hospital.
All right, they're on their way.
They're on their way, sweetie, okay? I don't know your name or nothing. But I want you to know that I love you, and I'm proud of you. It's a good thing you're giving up. We all go through something in life.
Remind us briefly of the story of what happened with this shooter and this employee.
Yeah, I'm just remembering listening to that clip, how amazing it is that she said these things. So essentially, the film is inspired by this 911 call that made national news back in 2013. And Antoinette Tuff was in the front office filling in for the receptionist at the front office at the elementary school when Michael Hill walked in with an AK-47. And, he took her hostage or sort of asked her to become a conduit to the police. And then what transpired between them is what the film is.
So let's hear actually a clip as she begins to try to reach out to him. This is, again, the shooter talking with that school employee who's being held at gunpoint.
I can help. You want me to try? Maybe I can talk to him and help you somehow.
It don't matter. I'm going to go away for a long time.
If I talk to them, maybe we can work something out where you won't have to go away with them for a long time.
It don't matter. I'm already on probation.
But that doesn't matter. I could tell them that you haven't harmed me or tried to do anything with me.
I shot the police.
But that doesn't matter. You didn't hit anybody.
You don't know that.
So that perpetrator in real life was a 20-year-old, Michael Brandon Hill. He did go away for a long time. He was sentenced to 2 decades in prison. Did you need to speak to Antoinette Tough or Michael Hill before you got started on the film?
I didn't speak to them directly before I got started. In part, you know, I made this film as a student, and you know, was really moved by her words and actions, and wasn't actually sure how the film would turn out. And so, I compiled all kinds of research. Obviously, the call. There were police reports and court documents and video camera footage from the actual school office. And I sort of compiled that research and then began my adaptation process. I've since, reached out to Antoinette and I've written a letter to Michael.
You know, this is one of those films that's a little bit like say, the classic 12 Angry Men or something, right? Like, there's no car chases. It mostly takes place in one room with a limited number of characters. How do you handle that kind of challenge? You know, in order to keep people interested, sometimes people try a lot of CGI and special effects and scene changes. This doesn't have that.
Well, it's so funny you mentioned 12 Angry Men, actually, because that was a reference point for me when I was writing the script and trying to convince myself that it would actually work.
You're kidding.
I actually watched that film a number of times and used it as a reference in talking to other people about the film because, of course, you know, there's an impulse to, as you say, to sort of crank up the tension and cross-cut between what's going on outside and inside. The thing I kept coming back to was my experience of this story was just purely auditory. And I didn't have any visuals. The only thing I had were Antoinette's voice, Michael's voice, and the voice of that dispatcher.
Hello, ma'am. Okay. He said to tell them to back off. He doesn't want the kids. He wants the police. So back off. And what else, sir? He said he don't care if he dies. He don't have nothing to live for. And he said he's not mentally stable.
Okay, stay on the line with me, okay? Put the phone down if you have to, but don't put it on hold so I can't hear.
Okay.
That actually created, obviously, an identification with the people inside that room and a question as to what was going on outside of the room. And I felt that was dramatic enough and, and the focus is really between what transpires between Antoinette and Michael and not actually what's happening with the cops.
How closely did you stick to what was really said in that office?
As closely as I possibly could. I mean, my first draft of the script was just the transcript in a Word document. And then it became a process of figuring out, of course, how to start the film, end it, give it some sort of shape. But the goal was always, to not make anything dramatic that wasn't true or true to what happened or even true to the flow of what happened between them, and also not to sensationalize it or make any sort of movie moment that just was not the truth of what happened.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Reed Van Dyke. He's the writer and director of the short film DeKalb Elementary that has been nominated for an Oscar. The film is based on an actual school shooting that happened in 2013 at the Ronald McNair Discovery Learning Academy in Decatur. And I wonder, Reed, how quickly you decided you wanted to turn that, what was originally a news report, into a film.
It took a little while. I mean, I stumbled on the call accidentally. I hadn't heard about the story back when it happened in 2013. I was doing research for another script I was writing about a mass shooting incident. And for that script, I just needed to know how a 911 dispatcher answers the phone. Like, what's the protocol? What do they say? And I Googled 911 call, and that happened to be the call that popped up.
Wow.
And so I listened to it, and I couldn't stop. I mean, I kept pausing it because I would become overwhelmed with feeling for both of these people and just this extraordinary circumstance and obviously, her remarkable compassion. And so, I mean, I kept thinking about her and I kept thinking about him and for probably a couple weeks. And then eventually I thought, gosh, maybe I could try to turn this into a short. I was a student at UCLA at the time and I had to make a short film for my next project. And I thought, well, maybe I could try to do justice to this story.
What do you think the story says that still resonates now? I mean, what as you, are you as a filmmaker trying to point out about this real-life situation?
One of the things I've tried to do is to construct the story in such a way that it's not messaging you or preaching to you, but I mean, I continue to respond, you know, even listening to Antoinette. I listened to the call briefly yesterday, and I was overwhelmed by her orientation
still.
It's overwhelming, her orientation toward people in general, toward him, you know, to look at somebody who would have very understandably inspired fear. And she, you know, she saw a person who was suffering and who needed help.
It's going to be all right, sweet. I just want you to know that I love you, though, okay? And I'm proud of you. That's a good thing that you've just given up and don't worry about it. We all go through something in life. No, you don't want that. You're going to be okay. I thought the same thing. You know, I tried to commit suicide last year after my husband left me. But look at me now. I'm still working and everything is okay.
I wonder if all this work that you've done on this film, you know, a sad fact of modern day America at this point is that there are new headlines about shootings and often school shootings. And I wonder how your work on this film has colored your perception of those headlines when they occur.
I think it's helped me perhaps not to become desensitized to them. It's very hard. There are stories now, you know, that I'm reading about how we've all sort of turned away from these stories. They recur so frequently that we're almost, yeah, desensitized. And, you know, I became very interested in this subject matter. Just this film is one way in which I sort of worked out my own interest in the subject and this phenomenon of mass shootings in the country. But I suppose it helps me to continue to take an interest in this distinctly American phenomenon.
Would you make another short film? I mean, this one was made because it was an assignment for school. But do you like the format?
I do. I mean, I've certainly gotten, I think many of us, we internalize and absorb the sort of structure of a feature-length film. But now having been working at shorts for the past, you know, 5-10 years, and I do feel more comfortable with this form. This film was not my thesis film at school, so I actually have one more short that I just finished in December. That will hopefully show up at some festivals this year or next.
And I wonder what it's like for you now to watch it, even after all this time. Do you still feel like tinkering with it?
Yeah. One is always, many writer-director friends, we're all our own worst critics. And so, yeah, you know, there's always things you'd want to do. But it's also nice to enjoy it with an audience who's experiencing it for the first time because you can get to see it through their eyes.
That's Reed Van Dyke, the writer and director of the short film DeKalb Elementary. It's based on an actual school shooting in Georgia and is up for an Academy Award. Just ahead, understanding the legacy of the only two African Americans to ever sit on our nation's highest court. But first, a new film explores the history of HBCUs. This is On Second Thought.
I was born by the river. In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. For more than 100 years, America's historically black colleges and universities have graduated many of our most dynamic and influential citizens. But some educators worry that a quarter of those schools could be gone within the next 20 years. Tomorrow, we'll discuss a new Atlanta Journal-Constitution series on the future of HBCUs. But first, a look at their past. A documentary airs tonight on PBS that explores the complex history of these schools. It's called Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of black colleges and universities. Filmmaker Stanley Nelson is behind that project, and he joins me on the line. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Could we start with that quote, Tell Me We Are Rising, which you chose as the title of the documentary. Where does that come from?
It came from a quote right after the a little bit after the Civil War, a Northern general went to visit the South and kind of to report back on the state of schooling in the South. And he asked a group of black students, you know, what should I tell them up north? What should I tell them about what's going on down south? And a young man rose up and said, tell them we are rising. And we heard that quote and immediately said, you know, this is it. We've got the title of the film.
Let me play something from the documentary. These are the words of Booker T. Washington.
I had no schooling whatsoever while I was a slave. On several occasions, I went as far as a schoolhouse door with one of my young mistresses. I had the feeling that getting into that schoolhouse would be the same as getting into paradise.
So the documentary really paints a vivid picture of the views of slaves, at former slaves, towards schooling and why they yearned to learn how to read. Was that just a function of having been denied schooling?
No, I mean, I think it's a function of a number of things. But that is, you know, one of the central points is that, you know, not only was schooling denied, it was forbidden, you know. And as when somebody says in the film, you know, a slave master could do anything they wanted to a slave. But one thing they couldn't do was educate the slave. I mean, there were laws on the books throughout the South that made it illegal not only for black people to learn to read and write, but it made it illegal for white people to teach black people to read and write.
And there's an incredible statistic I was unaware of in the documentary in which it said that some 20,000 people, both black and white, were killed, lynched, because they were either trying to learn or trying to educate in the South.
Right. There's an incredible scene in the film where a white man who had gone to the South to teach African Americans to read and write after the Civil War is going to be lynched for teaching to read and write, teaching education. And he's about to be lynched, and they give him a chance to write a letter home. And he writes a letter that starts, you know, "My dear, I die tonight." And he goes on to say, just for teaching black people how to read and write. And in fact, he is killed. He's murdered. He's lynched. And that happened all over the South. That's how feared education was.
So it is interesting, though, that some of these schools and some of the schooling began by either white individuals or by white groups that didn't necessarily believe in the intellectual equality of the African American race.
Right. I mean, that you know, there was a knowledge, especially in the North, from what we'll call missionary societies, that you know, you have this population of millions of African Americans who were freed by the Civil War and who are not educated. And so there was this idea that they have to be educated, but there was also this thought by many of them that African Americans were not really equal to white folks. And, you know, we'll educate them in what way we can, but they are not equal to white folks.
And the man who founded Hampton University really wanted to teach African Americans in the trades.
Right. That was one of the things that came out of this idea that African Americans were not equal, is this idea of what was called industrial education, which was an education for service. So, you know, we'll educate African Americans to be great cooks and great carpenters and great bricklayers and leather workers and those kind of things to in fact, you know, kind of perform the same duties that they performed, you know, under enslavement, basically.
So I want to play this comment from Mary Beth Gassman, who directs the Penn Center for Minority-Serving Institutions at the University of Pennsylvania. And this is a comment that she made when she was on the podcast, Historically Black.
It isn't a good idea to think of them as all alike, because they're not. The one thing that they have in common is that they, at their core, they were all started to engage in racial uplift and support African Americans.
Is that the one common thread? Because coming away from your documentary, it's clear that the history of HBCUs is really diverse. But were they all started to uplift the race?
I think so. I mean, if you look at simply getting an education as uplifting the race, so, you know, some institutions might be more political minded than the next, but I think they were all started to uplift the race. Again, if you broaden that term to mean, you know, educate the race. And I think a part of the kind of politicalness, if you will, of HBCUs has come from the students, and that's come over time.
Another thing that may be surprising, well, it was surprising to me anyway, was the pushback that some cities had that didn't want these schools in their communities.
Yeah, there's an incredible sequence in the film where black people try to start a school in New Haven, Connecticut, the home of Yale. And this is before the Civil War, and basically the town uprises, the mayor and the town uprises and says, no, you can't have a college here to educate black people. That'll ruin our city if you can believe it, if you bring black people here who want to have a college education. Again, that's how fearful education was.
So then let's fast forward just a little bit and talk about the effect that it had when African Americans are finally able to go to these schools and get their degree. And it appears that it had more than just the value of the degree. This is Dorothy Smith that you spoke with. She's an alum of Bennett College, an HBCU in North Carolina. And she remembers being interviewed to attend Wilson College first, which was a non-HBCU school.
I have not forgotten her words. Your grades are wonderful, but we're a little concerned because we don't know with whom you would be paired, because we cater to a lot of Southern gentlewomen and they room in suites. Sorry, kid. So I didn't get to Wilson. I applied to Bennett for a scholarship. It was kind of special.
So what did you hear about the effect that having these HBCUs had on, I guess, the morale of a generation?
Well, you know, that also is very personal for me. My parents both went to HBCUs. My mother went to Talladega in Alabama. And my father, he and his brother were the first people in his family to graduate high school in Washington, D.C. He went on to go to Howard University and then went to Howard Dental School. And it was only because HBCUs gave him an opportunity to go to college, that he went to college. This was in the 1930s and 40s that he went to college. It was only because HBCUs provided this nurturing environment where they told him, you know, you can do it. You know, this will work. You can do it. That he was able to go on and live the life that he lived, which allows me to have the life that I live and my kids' lives that they live and on down through the generations because HBCUs were there for him.
I'm speaking with filmmaker Stanley Nelson. His latest project is Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of black colleges and universities. It airs tonight on GPB TV. Let's hear another comment. Edward Waters College is the oldest HBCU in Florida, and college president Nathaniel Glover is actually a graduate of the school from 1966. He was Florida's first black sheriff since Reconstruction, and here he is speaking to WFSU Radio that he views his role as an educator, much the same as he viewed his role as sheriff in terms of saving lives.
Some of these students would never see the light of day if they didn't have Edward Waters College. And you know what? I am one of those students. It was almost like vindication being able to come back as the president of a college after having made a career of arresting young people. It is the epitome of redemption, I think.
This was what he's talking about is something that was echoed from a number of people in your documentary. And I wonder if you think that was that view of HBCUs was generational, that one of the reasons HBCUs are struggling is because the younger generation doesn't see them as a lifeline.
I think that first I want to say that a lot of HBCUs and probably the majority of them are not struggling. You know, I mean, we went to probably 30 HBCUs with this film, and these are, you know, strong, incredible institutions. You know, they have, you know, huge buildings and, you know, libraries, and they are, you know, viable institutions. But I think some of the reason some HBCUs are struggling is because partially, you know, they're not supported as they should be by alumni, and not supported as they should be by the general community. I think that, you know, you have no more committed and enthusiastic alumni group than alumni of HBCUs. you know, we've done screenings around the country. People come in their school colors. They come in their fraternity and sorority colors. They stand up and cheer when there's a picture of their school on in the film. But they need to give back, and I think that's one of the things that needs to happen for HBCUs. They need to give back. But also, I think all Americans need to give back, and I think when people see the film, hopefully they'll understand why HBCUs are important to all of us, you know, not just African Americans.
So when Booker T. Washington became a president of a university, he was the only black person to head one of these schools. When did the tide sort of begin to turn in terms of having a mostly black faculty and administration at some of these schools?
Yeah, well, we tell a great story about Fisk University in the 20s, and the students there kind of uprise against the draconian measures that are instituted by the president, the white president there, who, you know, he won't let the students, male and female students, walk together. They can't even walk together. He does away with fraternities, sororities, a lot of the sports teams. And the students hold a strike, you know, they hold a strike for weeks and weeks, and finally he has to resign. And I think at that point, you know, students of HBCUs across the country realize that they have power and that the schools really have to adjust to them and change with the times. And so the schools begin to change. One of the great things, the interesting points about Fisk is that the guy, the president who succeeded, the president that was ousted, was also white, but he was much more in tune with the students.
So then I want to play you this comment from Walter Kimbrough, who is president of Dillard University, which is an HBCU in New Orleans. And here he is speaking to NPR.
When I was president of Philander Smith in Little Rock, we had a white female student who comes to Philander Smith. She's one of a handful of white students. She joins a historically black sorority. She's very engaged. She doesn't act like someone that she isn't, and she's fully engaged in the life of that campus. So there should be more students who are looking for that kind of experience as well, but it always seems that we expect black students to be the ones that will have to go out and experience, you know, these diverse environments. And
Stanley, do you think HBCUs at this point are as welcoming to white students as they are to blacks?
I think they are. I mean, at schools, there's a number of white students. They've always been welcoming to white students. There's never been like you had to be black to go to an HBCU. They've always been very diverse. Some HBCUs have a huge Latino population at this point, and many schools have a number of white students. And, you know, I think for the white students at HBCUs, they get, for 4 years of their life, they get a totally different view of America and a view that can serve them very, very well for the rest of their lives.
You know, the debate over HBCUs has been renewed under the Trump administration, mainly because I guess there were promises that he made during his meeting with the presidents of those colleges and universities, and then he changed his mind in terms of support for the HBCUs. And I wonder whether you think HBCUs are still necessary, or should we be working harder to make sure that our public universities, all of them, are as diverse and welcoming to all races as we want them to be?
Well, I think, you know, I agree with both of those statements. Obviously, we want our all of our institutions to be more diverse and more welcoming. But I think HBCUs are still needed because, until we end racism and racialism in this country, until every student entering kindergarten and first grade, you know, has the same chance of an education as they go through junior high and high school, until that day, we still need HBCUs. And I think it's a question that you know, we shouldn't even be asking. You know, we don't ask, do we still need Catholic universities? We don't ask, do we still need women's colleges? We don't ask, do we still need yeshiva? We don't ask these things. So I think it's important that we understand that HBCUs are still needed. They still graduate an outsized number of African Americans who go into the STEM field. They still graduate an outsized number of African Americans who go into law, medicine, dentistry, who become judges. So HBCUs, I think, are still needed. And I think, you know, if we want to have the country that I think we all want to have, where every person has an opportunity to get a higher education if they want it, where every person has the opportunity to have their lives fulfilled, I think HBCUs are needed.
That is filmmaker Stanley Nelson. His latest project is called Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of black colleges and universities. It airs tonight at 9 o'clock on GPB TV. Stanley, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Tomorrow we'll talk about the future of HBCUs, but if you attended or attend an HBCU, tell us which school, why you chose to go there instead of somewhere else. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk. A shout out to Clark Atlanta. My great-grandmother went and got her teaching degree at Atlanta University a few years after the Civil War ended, and she wasn't a slave anymore back in the 1870s. So just ahead, the stories of the nation's first African-American Supreme Court justices. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow we talk with immigration activist Marie Marquardt. In her new novel, Flight Season, Marquardt draws on her experience with immigrant teens. And I wonder what you think about the debate over dreamers. Let us know what you think should be done with those who are brought to the United States by their parents at a very young age. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. In many ways, the battle for school desegregation might not have been possible without the support of this man.
All of a sudden, he just looked at me and said, you know something, Thurgood? I said, no, sir, what's that? He said, I'm going to put you on the Supreme Court. And I said, what did you say? And he said, that's it.
That's Thurgood Marshall reflecting on President Lyndon Johnson's decision to nominate him to the U.S. Supreme Court. Marshall's Senate confirmation made him the first African-American to sit on the highest court. And this month, Atlanta grade schoolers witnessed Marshall's life play out before their eyes. Actor John Doyle portrayed Marshall in a one-man show at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Museum and Library. On Second Thought, interns Emmanuel Johnson and Reed Williams joined them and brought back this audio postcard.
The first African-American to serve as a Supreme Court judge. I'm Thurgood Marshall. Now, pleased to meet you.
My name is John Edward Doyle Jr. I am an actor and a storyteller, and today I have the pleasure of being Thurgood Marshall here at the Carter Center.
Thurgood. Well, your poor Miles are a little tired right now, isn't it? I'm sorry. So what I did, instead of saying Thurgood, I shortened it to Thurgood.
What I really truly love about theater is that it gives people a live experience. So especially for youth, it gives them a felt experience of who Thurgood Marshall is. It jumps off the page and now it becomes a real person. In this play, we get a chance to like see what he was like as a child and when he was their age.
Let me tell you, my father, he would often teach us how to debate and how to use our words.
All right, son.
Why should I give you 25 cents? You should give me 25 cents because I would learn financial responsibility. And
so it really gives them an opportunity to see, hey, this is a person that's a person, not just Thurgood Marshall, the Supreme Court judge, lawyer, but he's actually a person who became a judge.
The Supreme Court did say that the schools had to open the doors to blacks. But what the Supreme Court did not say was when.
It was much more than just the Brown versus Board of Education. It was much more than him being a Supreme Court judge. This man actually risked his life. You know, he had to go down, he had to travel down south at a time when, you know, horrendous against blacks. But then he was also known as this troublemaker, but he still had a passion and a purpose.
Good is coming. Thurgood is coming. Thurgood. Don't say it too loud. Because there was a scary organization that did not like me coming. They're known as the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan. Yeah.
My name is Ms. Thomas. I'm a fifth grade teacher at John Lewis Elementary School in DeKalb County Schools. Today was awesome for me. My students got a chance to actually see the presentation, and they actually loved it because we have been studying the different African Americans during this semester, not just Black History Month. So this was awesome for us.
My name is Brian. I learned that he of the 32 cases, he won 29 of them.
My name is Charlie. I enjoyed it. I thought it was interesting. It really reenacted Thurgood Marshall's life and the things that he did when he was in court and as a lawyer. I learned more. I knew a lot of it, but I learned a little bit more about Brown versus the Board of Education, and which is good to know.
Hi, my name is Leonel. I would like to fight for my freedom and justice for all people.
My parents taught me, only fight the law when you are sure that the law is on your side.
That's actor John Doyle playing U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall in a one-man show in performance at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Museum and Library. That story was produced by our interns, Emmanuel Johnson and Reed Williams. Yeah. Just a note, the following conversation may include language that's challenging for some listeners, so listen with caution. A Georgian replaced Thurgood Marshall on the U.S. Supreme Court. Clarence Thomas was a federal judge from Savannah when he was confirmed as an associate justice on October 15, 1991. But it was the media circus that surrounded his confirmation that made Thomas a household name. A young law professor named Anita Hill came forward to testify against Thomas before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The nation watched as Hill alleged Thomas made unwanted sexual advances toward her. The descriptions were graphic.
He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes. He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises or large breasts involved in various sex acts. On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess.
Clarence Thomas denied any wrongdoing, and then he threw his own accusations into what has now become an iconic phrase.
As a Black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity Blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you.
The U.S. Senate very narrowly confirmed Thomas, 52-48, and he became the second African-American on the high court. Today, we will look back on his tenure, and I'm joined by Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington. Good to have you back.
Good to be here, Celeste.
And also with us is Stephen Gottlieb. He teaches at Albany Law School in New York. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tanya, this high-tech lynching that he was talking about, that very concept, is something that he's kind of stuck to throughout his career and has repeated in various permutations. I want to play this clip from a 2013 interview on C-SPAN. And they asked Clarence Thomas if he ever thought he'd see an African-American become president, and here's what he said.
I knew that it would have to be a Black president who was approved by the elites. The media, because anybody they didn't agree with, they would take apart. And that will happen with virtually, you pick your person, any Black person who says something that is not the prescribed things that they expect from a Black person will be picked apart. You can pick anybody. Don't pick me. Pick anyone.
I'm going to pick him, though, because it almost sounds as though he's responding to people who say that he's too conservative. Is that fair?
I think what he is trying to say is that unless your politics or your expression of your politics is aligned with the established order, the status quo, that you are not going to be deemed acceptable or appropriate.
Let's go back a little further in his history and talk about his growing up in Georgia, because it's something that he has talked about as helping to form the justice that he is. Here he is speaking about his early days in Savannah.
I was the only black kid in my seminary in Savannah in 1965 to 67, and one of two in 1964 to 65. So you could see the world hadn't changed in Savannah. What I found in getting along with the white classmates is to look at them not as white kids or as different, but as kids. There's some less flawed, some who are flawed, some less flawed. I don't know. But in the end, they're all human beings.
So Clarence Thomas was born in Pinpoint, Georgia, in 1948, which was not an easy time to be a black kid in the South. How do you think that experience may have influenced him as a juror?
Well, as he expressed, he tried to see kids not for their color, but as just children. That he was in classes with. And I think if you fast forward to a lot of his jurisprudence that expresses the idea of colorblindness as the constitutional ideal, that we are going to apply the law without regard for color, it's consistent with the ways in which he navigated those spaces where he was the only black person, was to not see the color of his classmates. And he also worked really hard not to fit the stereotype. But in doing that, you don't give yourself permission to be yourself. We don't have to be perfect as black people or black jurists to be equal. And that attitude of I must assimilate in order to be treated as equal, I think resonates throughout a lot of his opinions as they relate to topics around race.
We're going to get into that for sure. We would love to hear from those of you listening. Tweet us now at OST or join our conversation on Facebook. My guests are law professors Tanya Washington of Georgia State University and Stephen Gottlieb of Albany Law School. But I wanted to go back, Stephen, to your comments about Clarence Thomas not talking. And when we say he's not talking, he's not speaking up or asking questions. People keep waiting for him to question people. Stephen, why doesn't he?
One can speculate that he has said from time to time that he doesn't see a lot of benefit in the process of oral argument, and therefore doesn't participate, although he's there.
That's one way in which he's sort of distinguished himself, is by being silent. But another way, Tanya, is that he was not the African-American judge many African-Americans were waiting for. In other words, somebody that might bring a very different, more sympathetic perspective to the court. Here he is during a forum at the Pepperdine University School of Law. He was asked about whether or not the Supreme Court has a role or a duty in combating racism.
I have never understood the notion that we could continue to focus on race in order to get over race. I've never understood that we have to continue to identify us in a, you know, to be race conscious in order not to be race conscious.
What can we glean from his decisions on issues of race?
Well, I think he's summed it up. He is of the mindset that the way to get over racial discrimination is to end racial discrimination. In other words, not to see race, to adopt a colorblind perspective and a colorblind jurisprudential philosophy where the law is neutral and takes no account of racial inequities, racial disparities, racialized realities. And that comes through in his opinions in the voting rights context, in the context of affirmative action, employment discrimination. So his perspective is one that if we really want to become a colorblind society, which he perceives as the ideal, the thing we do is to ignore race. Others who critique that perspective say, how can we eliminate racial discrimination, which clearly still exists by, you know, hard evidence,
right?
How do we get rid of that without first acknowledging the history and the reality of racism?
Can I supplement Tanya's answer there? I certainly agree with what she was saying, but I think there's an additional thing that we need to understand, and that is While on the one hand he talks about colorblind, and I would even describe what he's saying as what blacks don't get for themselves isn't worth having. But when you look at another set of cases where issues are raised on behalf of white parties, his jurisprudence is completely different. So when you look at, for example, there's a whole spate of cases involving the way the districts were drawn in a number of states.
Gerrymandering, yeah.
Various forms of gerrymandering and the application of the Voting Rights Act. And even in those situations where blacks were underrepresented, he was finding that the white group in that area wasn't sufficiently represented. So there's a dilemma there, or a contradiction there. There are a whole lot of different legal questions that were used to address those situations, but ultimately what's going on is that there's a preference for white complaints in a fairly large group of cases.
But it's not just racial decisions, I think, that Clarence Thomas has had a real impression on. Let's hear from him. This was an oral history interview. Former Georgia lawmaker and NAACP chair Jolene Bond was speaking with Thomas about what goes through his mind when he's writing his opinions.
These opinions have an enormously long shelf life, so it is critical that they not be based on shifting sands of fads and what's popular, but rather principles that are locked down and that will be here when the tides turn or the wind blows in a different direction.
So, Tanya, what will we remember? Still live and kicking and doing quite well, Clarence mm-hmm. Thomas, but what kind of legacy has he built so far?
I hope that we will remember him for his competency as a jurist, for his intellect, and not for the scandal that plagued his confirmation.
With Anita Hill.
Right, with Professor Hill. But questions about his competency and his ability as a judge on the Supreme Court, who had a higher ABA rating than Rehnquist, who served as the chief judge for many years, to me is the wrong critique. So I hope that he will have, an earned reputation as a jurist who expressed a certain perspective on the law, original intent, and what he considers to be kind of apolitical decision making, although there is no such thing as neutrality, in my opinion. But I hope that will be his legacy and not the legacy that's centered around his confirmation.
You just heard Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington and Albany Law School professor Stephen Gottlieb. And that's our show for today, but we want your thoughts. Today we talked about the history of historically black colleges and universities. If you attend or attended an HBCU, tell us which school you went to and why you chose to go there. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter at OSTTalk. I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.